Joshy Ross is back again, but this time in studio in Baltimore for this conference. We got him up here in our little studios. Author that we've talked about many times before. Incredible books that he's written. And have him in studio, which is something very, very different than we've had before. How do you say I love you? Like an Indian?
In Indian.
In Indian.
In Indian.
And don't know much about Indians.
That's right.
I always want to sing that song.
Yeah.
Don't know much about.
Yeah. That's right. And that's actually where it came from.
Right.
Uh-huh. I'm a big Sam Cooke fan.
Okay, there you go.
Yeah, I'm a big Sam Cooke fan. I went through this period around 2005 where all I listened to for probably about 2 years was the Beatles and Sam Cooke. And that was where that title came from.
That's cool. I like that.
Yeah.
So welcome to Baltimore, man. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much. It's fun to be. Is it the Magic City or
Monument City?
No, but there's something else though. It's Charm City.
Charm City.
Charm City. Yeah, it's nice to be Charm City. You're very charming. Charm City. Yeah, you know. It's
Charm cool City. To be here. Murder City.
Murder City.
Mob Town.
The Wire City.
The Wire City.
Yeah, was it Snooki or Snoopy? Snoopy. What's the young lady on?
Oh yes, Snoop. What is her name? Snoop.
Snoop. Yeah, Snoop City.
Snoop.
Right. What up, Snoop?
She's been on our show a bunch of times. Couple times, yes.
Okay. She's truly from here, right? She's indigenous to Baltimore.
And Snoop is Snoop.
And she's just really Snoop.
She's Snoop.
Yeah, good for her.
She's Snoop.
Do you, girl.
She's Snoop. Something you said a little while ago. Mm-hmm. We talked about Andrew Jackson.
Yes.
And you said seventh president of the United States, Andrew Jackson, was not a beast. You used a word to describe Andrew Jackson.
I think I said a beast.
Beast.
Yeah.
Right.
He was a beast.
And so what I really thought of when you said Andrew Jackson was a beast is how we have to learn how to really tell our history in different ways to even describe who we are today.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that we look at a president
who
now is on the $20 bill, known as the founder of the Democratic Party,
yes,
of giving freedom and democracy to white men, really, but we don't say white men when we say it,
right,
was a beast.
Yeah. And, you know, that's one of the things of getting rid. We spoke about this before. America loves mythology. We love mythology. We love Santa Claus. We love the notion that Abraham Lincoln was the great liberator. And we pretend that he wasn't the person that, promoted up until way after it was cool, the colonization of Liberia or Haiti to get rid of all the black folks that had been enslaved. We pretend that he didn't say, if he could preserve the Union and not free one slave, that he would do it. Those are all myths that this is the great liberator. He didn't liberate one person. Andrew Jackson, he was many, many things. He was definitely somebody who antagonized specifically Native people. He was responsible for the Trail of Tears. He was reportedly – and there's some dispute as of the historical record, but after Chief Justice Marshall said that the Cherokee Indians had a right to be in Georgia. He said that you can't mess with them. Of course, the decision was a little bit longer than that because he was a judge. He's a lawyer, so lawyers talk too much. But he said they have a right to be in Georgia. Andrew Jackson said, well, Justice Marshall made the ruling. Let him enforce it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
He had a special antipathy toward Indian people. And that's fine, because at that time, a lot of people did. And people make, as a matter of historical record, they do bad stuff. We can live with that because that's just part of evolution. That's part of growing. But for us to hold on to such a romantic notion that these folks were somehow infallible and that they weren't a victim of their particular time period and their particular pathologies, that means that neurosis that affected them, that racism that affected them, is somehow still reaching way into the future and affecting us today. It's given us in real time some serious problems to the degree that we deny their racism and we allow it to be that mythological story instead of the true story. And that's really dangerous. That's fine. They had their time. They did their damage at that particular time. He was a beast at that particular time. But don't let that make you a beast today by telling the wrong story, right?
Mm-hmm. No, exactly. And I think that's also part of the battle of his being on the $20 bill.
Yeah.
And people may be saying to reinvent our country, mm-hmm. to reinvent our way of life.
Yeah.
That we should think who else should be there representing us when we make a purchase, when we that symbolizes who we are.
Yeah, and even the way that conversation is going, that's cool. But we want to have a sandwich without using bread. We want to go through the hard work of replacing Andrew Jackson with Harriet Tubman or with some other incredible historic figure. And that's good. But we should also have the conversation why this particular person or other people are uniquely qualified to be removed. Because it's just as important that you talk about that history as you talk, you promote the stories of these other folks as well. That's about, you know, that's being honest with history. We cannot, I don't think, really expect. And I don't think we should really expect. I think it's dishonest to expect us to want to replace somebody in the annals of history on this pantheon of amazing white dudes and without saying exactly why we're doing it. Let's make them accountable for that moment in history. Let's say exactly what these people did. Andrew Jackson was directly responsible for the killing of 4,000 Cherokee Indians in that westward march from Georgia to Oklahoma. Let's talk about that. You know, that 4,000 people, that's a pretty substantial amount. You're talking about World Trade Center numbers, right? Mm-hmm. And that's fine. Like, that happened. But why can't we have a conversation instead of just bloodlessly trying to replace him and saying, well, these other people are better? No, not only are they better, but this guy was affirmatively bad.
And I think that that kind of stuff is important because when we think of part of what you bring to the table, I think, and some of the work you're doing is important, at least I perceive it that way, is when we talk about race and racism in the history of this country, we don't bring the Native voice to the table or racism that comes from the vision and history and feelings and experiences of Native people in America. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's always over here. It's left out of the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely. But, you know, in my estimation, I rely upon history a lot. And the reason why I rely upon history a lot is because it's important for a brown person to rely upon history a lot so that when I talk about Andrew Jackson, you're not talking about him as a matter of conjecture or opinion. You're talking about him because a man from Pittsburgh, his name was Derek Bell. Derek Bell talked about the five rules of racial standing. One of those rules is that brown people, he was talking about black people specifically, but brown people in general are presumed incompetent to speak about race because we cannot be objective. And that seems to be the perception. I think that's a very, very fair statement. And so, you know, I try to understand that rule. And in understanding that rule, I realize that instead of just speaking my opinion, because I can't be objective according to a lot of folks, instead I have to defer to these books that white people wrote about a particular person. Andrew Jackson, I'm not saying he's a bad person. History tells me in respectable books written by respectable white people tells me he was a beast. It's not my opinion. It's everybody else's. That's what history says. And so, you know, I try to defer to that and say that irrespective of whether it's a Native position or a black position, the facts are the facts. We got to tell a much more robust and full story about history. And, you know, that to me is not Native history. That to me is not black history. That's just history. There's no disclaimer needed. There's no adjective needed. That's just all it is history. We need to tell history for what it is and let people make up their own minds about whether this person, you know, really was as bad as I purport or really as good as the people from the United States government purport who continue to circulate money that has his face on it.
And I think that that kind of stuff is important because when we think of part of what you bring to the table, I think, and some of the work you're doing is important, at least I perceive it that way, is when we talk about race and racism in the history of this country, we don't bring the Native voice to the table or racism that comes from the vision and history and feelings and experiences of Native people in America. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's always over here. It's left out of the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, definitely. But, you know, in my estimation, I rely upon history a lot. And the reason why I rely upon history a lot is because it's important for a brown person to rely upon history a lot so that when I talk about Andrew Jackson, you're not talking about him as a matter of conjecture or opinion. You're talking about him because a man from Pittsburgh, his name was Derek Bell. Derek Bell talked about the five rules of racial standing. One of those rules is that brown people. He was talking about black people specifically, but brown people in general are presumed incompetent to speak about race because we cannot be objective. And that seems to be the perception. I think that's a very, very fair statement. And so, you know, I try to understand that rule. And in understanding that rule, I realize that instead of just speaking my opinion, because I can't be objective according to a lot of folks, instead I have to defer to these books that white people wrote about a particular person. Andrew Jackson, I'm not saying he's a bad person. History tells me in respectable books written by respectable white people tells me he was a beast. It's not my opinion. It's everybody else's. That's what history says. And so, you know, I try to defer to that and say that irrespective of whether it's a native position or a black position, the facts are the facts. We got to tell a much more robust and full story about history. And, you know, that to me is not native history. That to me is not black history. That's just history. There's no disclaimer needed. There's no adjective needed. That's just all it is history. We need to tell history for what it is and let people make up their own minds about whether this person, you know, really was as bad as I purport or really as good as the people from the United States government purport who continue to circulate money that has his face on it.
But I think, you know, it's also that when we look at this movement that's been built in this America right now in the last 10 years, well, 5 years with this name, but Black Lives Matter. And you and I have talked about this before. That one of the things that gets lost in this, well, not gets lost, doesn't get lost in, is not even thought about. When I looked at the statistics mm-hmm. of people who were killed by police in this country.
Yes.
And the group that is killed at a greater rate in terms of its population mm-hmm. by police in America are Indians, are Native people.
Yes. Yep. Native people, yeah, were killed at a higher – so just so there's no confusion. Native people are killed at a higher rate than any other ethnicity in the nation by police officers. And when you say that, obviously it offends a specific sense of positionality and – existential truth. No, that can't be the case. That can't be the case because we don't hear these cases of Native people being killed. And so it can't be the case. And, well, we also didn't hear about the Million Man March on Saturday. What it does is it makes us question if we're to accept those statistics that were not garnered, were not gathered by a Native organization,
no,
but were gathered instead by the United States Department of Justice, by the Center for Disease Control. Two organizations that, as a Native person, they don't call me. They don't ask me about those statistics. And so – but because it offends that notion of the way things really are, when that happens, you're put in a position as somebody who is intelligent to say either I'm just getting half the story and perhaps the media has a vested interest in only telling pieces of the story, or alternatively that – I just don't care, and other people just don't care about this particular ethnic group. Both of those, and if we say that all men are created equal, and if that we're considered a progressive person that presumably cares about everybody, well, then that's a problem. Both of those notions are problems. Well, I got to care about everybody. I got to care about everybody. So that's certainly not it. Or, well, man, but the media would not. You know, the media would not have these conversations and tell me something that's untruthful because that could mean that anything else that they're saying might also be untruthful. And so both of those possibilities are uncomfortable. And regards to Native people, I think that there's a quote by Cornel West. He talked about the existence of – he was talking specifically about black people. But he characterized it very, very well. Cornel West was at the Million Man March, and it was cool. He's sitting right in my section, and he's just a cool cat. So, Cornel, if you're there, you know, you're a great dude. But he talked about the absurdity of black existence in America. And he didn't mean that it was bad that they exist. I'm sure he loves the fact that they exist. That's cool because as a result, he exists. but the absurdity. And what that means for me, and maybe I'm reading this wrong, but for Native people, it's just an absurd existence that we have to constantly counter, and, you know, notions that people have. This is a true story. So I was down in Atlanta last week at the A3C Music Conference, and I was talking to these three very beautiful sisters, African-American ladies, in the hotel lobby. The one, she wanted to buy me a drink, and I didn't want a drink. I told her she could buy me some sweet potato fries instead. And so she bought me some sweet potato fries, and I'm sitting there talking to her. And said, very nice. And she was asking me, you know, she was asking me about my tribe and stuff. And she said, do you get that check? Do you get that check that Indians get? And I said, and I kind of smiled because, you know, I'm used to these questions. I went to school in New York City. I said, what check is that? She said, you know, that check that Indians get. And I said, you know, I've never gotten a check. I said, I've never gotten a check in my life. And she said, I've read about it. I've read about it. And I said, well, you know, your books are wrong. Your books are wrong. I said, you know, I mean, that's cool. You read about it, but, you know. And she said, well, no. She said, I'm gonna go do some research afterward. She's questioning me about the reality that I live every single day based upon her assumptions of what Native people are supposed to be. That happens a lot, Mark. It's not once or twice. And so that's just absurd. I remember I was on a train in New York City once, and I was sitting across. I was wearing my hair in two braids, and there's this older white dude that was sitting across the way with his wife, but either way, it was his significant other, his lady. And he just kept on smiling at me. He kept on smiling at me, and I smiled back. Hey, what's up? And I put my head down, and, you know, when I get close to my stop, he's still looking at me. And then I look at him, and he, what's up, man? He said, oh, I was just wondering, are you Native American? I said, and usually I wouldn't respond, but, you know, I was getting off the train. I said, yeah, why? He said, well, I thought so. He said, except for Native Americans can't grow facial hair. It's like, oh, thanks for letting me know that. And there's so many people that presume to know about us and have assumptions that have been built over the course of 500 years of white domination, white supremacy. These are stereotypes. You would never tell, you know, I hope you would never tell somebody else something that essentialist, that reduces them to that level of inhumanity, that I have no volition, I have no individuality within this particular equation. I'm simply the product. I'm simply a carbon copy of every other stereotype that applies to Native people. But that happens to us all the time. That's absurd. It's not, I'm not going to put judgment on it. It's not good or bad. It's absurd that we have to explain our existence. We have to justify our existence. I spoke this week at a conference called Courageous Conversations. It was a great conference here mm-hmm. in Baltimore. It was incredible. And I laid a statistic out, and this is true. 3 in 5 Native women are the victim of sexual assaults. This is empirically true. Gathered data from the United States Department of Justice. 3 in 5 Native women are the victim of sexual assaults. 70% in some jurisdictions of federal prosecutors, U.S. attorneys, decline 70% of sexual assault cases. So that's absurd, because not only are these women getting assaulted, but they're getting reassaulted by the feds who took over jurisdiction by virtue of an act of Congress called the Major Crimes Act. They won't even prosecute these crimes. That's absurd. Up until the late 1970s, there were documented examples of the Indian Health Services, the doctors who have the trust responsibility via treaty to provide health care to Native people, Indian Health Services doctors who forcefully ligated the fallopian tubes of Native women until the late 1970s. That was within my lifetime.
The late 1970s.
Yes, absolutely. And That's something that offends our notion, all of our notion, people that consider themselves America, American, their notion of, no, that really can't happen. No, you're lying. You're putting me on. No, it really happened. This really happened. And that's what we get when we talk about Native history. That's when we talk about Andrew Jackson, when we talk about Henry Pratt. We talk about all these people, the Supreme Court, that said things in open court or in public spaces as a matter of historical record that would offend every single person within this country's idea of what can be. And they would be that person that said, no, that really didn't happen. Native people really can't grow facial hair. No, you really get that Indian check. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And in the absurdity, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
I mean, it's because everything I know, everything I have read, everything I have experienced in the years I've been on this planet is that Native people have been, I think, more than almost any other people in this country, the non-people.
Yeah.
The mythology of something, the refuse of what was.
Yes. Yes. Right? Who cannot own a position or agency in the here and now. That's the reason why people feel comfortable. Jeb Bush last week, and I've been not particularly ingratiated into the Redskins debate, but I am ingratiated into the part of it that affects our voice, our ability to speak up for ourselves. And when Jeb Bush, privileged white man, says Native people are not offended by this icon, by this symbol, okay, who'd you talk to? Give me some sources. That may or may not be the case, but how dare you talk for us? How dare you, young lady in Atlanta, say that despite me living, you know, a very long life, I've been Native American pretty much my whole life. But yet she's telling me what I receive on a monthly basis, that I go to school for free and then I get this check, this mysterious. I wish I did. If I told her, I would be swinging it. I'll be, you know, waving it with pride. I don't get it. But yet people purport to know so much about us than us.
And so in a way, being part of a nation and being having been dwindled down just in numbers to such a small minority of people in the land when that was your land, 0.8%, if I have it right, 0.0, do I have that 0.08?
Yeah, it's close.
Whatever number that is, right?
1%, I say 1%.
1%, fine.
Yeah.
And so it becomes ignored, also because the difference is also that in this world, Mexican Americans, Puerto Ricans, black folks in America, Jews in America, any number of minorities, all have representatives in Congress representing public faces.
Yeah.
And in many ways, there are very few, if any. I mean, maybe you can think of
Brad Cole from Oklahoma.
Brad Cole from Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Right, right. Republican.
Yeah, Republican. Yeah.
But
come on, brother.
But the public face.
Yeah.
That's part of it, too.
Yeah.
The absurdity and invisibility.
Right.
I think invisibility is what I was looking for.
Yeah, and it's interesting because I think there's actual intent there. Maybe not so much today. You know, people tend to do the same things that they've always done. We're all creatures of habit, right? But I think we got out of the habit of representing Native voices. L. Frank Baum, the author of the Wizard of Oz, he talked about after the murder of Sitting Bull, he talked about the need as sort of this existential thing to wipe the remaining Indians off the face of the planet.
He said that.
He actually said that.
He actually said that.
And I think that's indicative of this existential, superstitious nature that people – look, as long as they exist, it's this haunting presence that's a reminder of how badly, how inhumane we've treated a portion of our population. I think it's the same thing that – you know, compelled Abraham Lincoln, even 50 years after the American Colonization Society that included such people as Francis Scott Key, who was the author of the Star-Spangled Banner, Thomas Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Clay. I mean, all these luminaries. They wanted to get rid of black folks. And it's because it's this stark reminder. Your presence, black person, your presence, native person, is a reminder that just how terrible, how inhumane, how savage, and how much of a beast our ancestors were. That's a powerful thing. Your state, you're living in a place that has 70% unemployment, is this visual reminder that, yeah, we did something really wrong. That we never lived up to our promise. We said all men are created equal. We were kind of playing. We were joking a little bit.
Yeah, right.
And so I think that is one of the reasons why there's not honest imagery of Native people, that we would rather, you know, show us as a object from the past, or alternatively this noble savage idea, because in that capacity we don't have to show or tell a more comprehensive narrative about us.
You know, I think also people in terms of political movements and cultural movements also don't get, unless you live in a certain area, don't get what's happening in the native world, mm-hmm. or the power of what's happening inside the native world.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, it's... Again, I can't. There's something really important to me about, speaking of Mr. Baum,
mm-hmm. yeah,
of and Mr. Oz,
yeah,
of opening the curtain,
right? Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
opening the curtain.
Yes,
and to unmask the invisibility,
mm-hmm.
to expose it,
right?
Because we don't. Because you said on the program a little bit ago to me. I said something to you about if the power of Native people and the importance of the role of in movements of changing where we are as a culture and as a people. And you said something about even if we were just the ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah. We.
You know?
I mean, you cannot, as a matter of historical fact, as a matter of you know, empirical data, as a matter of population, you can't separate us from the land. You can't tell the story of America without telling, you know, it's like Woody Allen, right? He made a movie called Manhattan that didn't have any black people in it.
What about now in the future? When you think about the future, I mean, we were talking before we came in here, your son who's 8,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Your brother who's now, who is an actor,
mm-hmm.
and you have other siblings, you told me they were the only one who didn't die, they all dived. And you yourself, I mean, grew up in the res. You went to Columbia Law School.
Yes.
Back on the res.
Yes.
This is where your home is, where you feel that you need to be, want to be.
Yeah.
But talk about what you think then is the future. What is the future in terms of your vision, your thought, your analysis about where the society is?
Yeah. Well, my vision isn't particularly optimistic.
Okay.
You know, I think that there's a... I think America has an opportunity for reconciliation with its various groups that it's historically oppressed and did horrible atrocities to, and it has a small margin for error regarding that hope for reconciliation, and we already see cracks at the seam of America. Those cracks are evident through our economy. At one time, we were on a gold standard because, you know, we had gold, and we are also, you know, our budget was very, very lucrative, and that was as a result of, you know, 400 years of free labor, 350 years of free labor. That tends to do it, a lot of free land. And now we see America, you know, where there are no manufacturing jobs,
right.
where there's, you know, its economy is based upon speculation and debt. That's fact. It's based upon debt. And it's based upon speculation, a little bit of tech stuff, definitely. But those jobs, I mean, you know, they just made this idiotic, you know, Boeing deal with China, right? And it sounds good for a second, but you know, China's business model is they tend to in-house all expertise. And so the fact that Boeing is going to go over there and set up a plant over there and create planes over there, that simply means that China's going to be very brilliantly sniping that expertise and learning how to make those planes themselves. And you know, so there's cracks at the seams. We're not making good business deals now. You know, there's this, oh, what is it, TPP?
Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Yeah, TPP. Obviously, we had some time ago NAFTA. We're making stupid business deals in hopes of a quick buck. And that tends to be the acts of a desperate person if you had to anthropomorphize this particular nation. And, you know, and so we're showing cracks. And moreover, there's cracks. You know, obviously, the Tea Party shows that there's white people who are very dissatisfied with this nation. You know, Ted Cruz, Rand Paul. I mean, John Boehner, he didn't just decide to resign. That was because he said, and he didn't say this. I mean, I'm making up, but I'm psychoanalyzing a little bit, reading the tea leaves. His notion was there's cracks in the seams of this party. They no longer – they're crazy. I don't understand them. They're like Chagor in No Country for Old Men. I don't get this guy. I don't get what they're doing. So we have that. We also had cracks that were showing during the recession with the Occupy movement. That was formerly gainfully employed white people largely that said, you know what, this American dream isn't all it's cracked up to be. Now, of course, the economy recovered, so they're asleep for a little while. They're dormant right now. All those occupiers, you know, they got rehired and stuff like that. But they'll be back around because there will be another recession. We have obviously dissatisfaction and shown by the folks, you know, with affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement, who are you know, thankfully protesting and creating change regarding this, you know, state-sponsored violence that has so profoundly affected the Black community. It's also, as we talked about, very profoundly affected the Native community. And all of those energies, you know, energy can't be created or destroyed. It simply changes form, right? That's thermodynamics. That's physical law. And all of those energies, those are going someplace. We see that. We see that here in Baltimore. Freddie Gray trial is going on right now. It's going to be some fireworks either way when that trial concludes. Energy can't be created or destroyed. Ferguson, Walter Scott, Aaron Gray. You know, there's all these different examples, and there will be, as James Baldwin talked about, more racial wars. This is, he said it in 1960. And what that means is that unless there's some honest inventory of our past crimes, how we fix those past crimes, you know, it's not unheard of. The state of Maine, very, very, you know, presciently, recently did concluded a Truth and Reconciliation Commission with some, I think it was the Penobscot natives up there. It was with one of the tribes up there. And they did that because they knew that at some point, as James Baldwin said, it has the sum effect of someone throwing a match in a powder keg. You know, you put people under enough pressure, you tell them that their voice does not count long enough, you tell them that they don't have enough value for long enough, and pretty soon something sparks. And so I don't expect America's institutions. I mean, we see Donald Trump. He wants to bring back the glory days, right?
Right.
You know, he wants to make America great again. What does that mean? It's code, right? It's code. And so when I see that, I see there's not enough humility in here. Last night, the terrible Democratic National Convention, the debate, you know, all the candidates except for Webb, you know, at very platitudinal, said, you know, Black Lives Matter. Yeah. They didn't say what that meant. They didn't say how you fix the situation. They said Black Lives Matter. Like that was a talisman. You know, that was the magic words and open sesame. Oh, okay, it's done. Jim Webb didn't even say that. You know, he said all lives matter, right? And you know, we're not humble enough. We're not contrite enough. We want to brush that history, like we talked about, just brush it under the rug and assume that it goes away. If we give these young folks that are affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement hey, we're going to give them some, you know, consulting jobs where they make $75,000 a year. And that's going to consume them. That's going to subsume them. And now all of a sudden, no, that's not going to happen. If it happens now, it's not. Look, at some point, this catches up to you. You can only pay people off for so long. And so unless we actually take inventory and try to do something other than just paying people off, doing something other than just simply sweeping these narratives under the rug, it's going to be bloody. We're not looking for reconciliation right now. We're looking for quick remedies, magic bullets, without having to say, number one, I'm sorry. Without, two, having to say, how can I make this better? Number three, let's talk publicly about this. No backroom deals. And unless we're willing to do that, there will be no reconciliation, and things are going to, on a racial level, on a economic inequality level, income inequality level, going to get a lot worse.
Joshy Ross, man, this is a great way to end this conversation for the day. We got much more to talk about over the years, but I want to thank you. It's very powerful.
Thank you very much.
Good to see you again.